Hello, web listeners. I'm Katie Didden, and this podcast is a recording of a conversation I had recently with Josh Crea. Josh is an assistant professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and his first book, Gleam, won the Knight Book Poetry Prize in 2005. I got a chance to speak with Josh when he came through Columbia to read for the Center for the Literary Arts reading series at the University of Missouri. I hope you enjoy the podcast. I'm Katie Didden, and it's my pleasure today to welcome Josh Crea to our office here at the University of Missouri. In some sense, this is a homecoming for Josh, as he was born and raised in St. Louis, so we're glad to welcome you back to your home state.
Thanks.
Josh is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop and received a PhD from the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, where he was a Schaefer Fellow in Poetry. He lives in Las Vegas with his wife and daughter, where he is a visiting assistant professor in UNLV's University College. He's also the poetry editor for the literary journal Witness. Josh has won numerous awards for his poetry, and in 2005, he was selected for the Knight Book Poetry Prize for his first book, Gleam. Last night, Josh gave a reading in the Green Chapel here on campus as part of the Center for the Literary Arts reading series. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you, Katie. I'm happy to be here.
We're glad you could come to visit us on your reading tour.
Yeah.
Tell me, since the publication of your book, where else have you given readings?
It's been mostly Missouri. I've had like two Missouri tours, so it's been kind of nice. St. Louis and surrounding area of St. Louis, but also I was in Warrensburg at Central Missouri State just recently, and then I was in Maryville up at Northwest Missouri State. So, and I was in Iowa, and I'll be doing a few more in the West Coast, closer to Las Vegas now, Santa Cruz and L.A. and San Francisco.
Great. So. What surprised you about doing a reading tour?
That people show up. That's the biggest surprise. It's been nice, especially since most of the readings I've been doing have been in Missouri. There's always been some sort of personal connection, either through family, being in St. Louis, having family and friends show up, but also coming out to Columbia, going to Warrensburg. I know a lot of people either on faculty or in those programs, so it's a really nice way to do a reading and to see old friends and to see programs and what's going on in these programs. So it's been a lot of fun.
So first I want to ask you to tell the listeners a little bit about the title of your book, Gleam, and where that came from and what it means.
It's been a while. I don't really exactly remember. I know I'd written a poem early on, that was entitled The Gleaning, and it had literally to do with gleaning, figures in a field picking up the leftovers after the field had sort of been picked already. So it's the literal meaning of sort of going after, picking up the refuse, what's left behind, from some other sort of harvest that had occurred before. And that poem never actually made it into this collection. It just sort of fell apart. But then the poem was shortened. I remember actually meeting with a professor of mine, talking to him about deciding on a title for the book. And I mentioned The Gleaning, and he thought it was a little too precious. It was a little too, way too precious, he thought. And so he said, well, why not, consider reducing it to glean? Very active, a little bit more active. Glean is sort of an imperative, but it's also something you can sort of, it just happens or has happened. And I think it works very well with the book. The book is a book about faith, or again, the sort of picking up elements of faith for me. And the project of the book is about refers back to my own Catholic faith, my upbringing in the Catholic faith, leaving that faith and sort of returning to it. But again, returning to it after this sort of harvest, after I'd already sort of been pretty assimilated into the church, pretty convinced that I was a Catholic or in my beliefs at one point. So after that had sort of, I'd abandoned that faith and sort of forgotten about it and then kind of came back. The title, I think, really evokes this idea of picking up what was left and sort of just delicately, bit by bit, sort of, going back and edging back towards the idea of faith. And just sort of picking up the leavings, finding what was sort of left behind in my own personal sort of spiritual history, but also in the tradition of the Catholic faith, church, etc. So.
Great. At the beginning of your book, there's an epigraph from Emily Dickinson. In it, you preserve a word that she presumably scratched out in a draft, the word annulled. I'm going to read the epigraph with the scratch out included. God cannot discontinue, annul himself. This appalling trust is at times all that remains. Tell me about this excerpt and your choice to include it. How does this set the stage for your poems?
I think it works partly what we were talking about in conjunction with the title itself. Again, this idea of gleaning or finding things that have been left behind or buried other places. This fragment from Dickinson I found in a facsimile of some of her work. It was sort of a poem. It's a poem that, as far as I know, it's never been published. It's not included in her collected poems. It's sort of just something that some marginalia that she had sort of written down at some place. And so I've always saw it in the facsimile, handwritten by Emily Dickinson. And in that facsimile, the most amazing thing, which you usually don't get necessarily once these are typed up and printed in books, you get to see her editing. And she had begun the poem, and who knows when she actually crossed out a null and then wrote discontinue above it, either after writing the fragment or right in the middle of it. But I thought it was just an incredible gesture that she, those two words, you know, really, really strong, but a null and discontinue, they're quite different. You know, a null is almost complete obliteration and erasure, just getting done with, whereas discontinue is just stopping, you know, leading up to a certain point and stopping, but the vestiges are still there. The remainder is, the memories are still there. So again, this idea of gleaning, it's still allowing for this idea or thinking about faith or God. I thought it was just a wonderful quote. I mean, this insistence that I was feeling in the book, that my faith wouldn't necessarily go away, ideas or conceptions of the divine wouldn't go away, that they just, you know, they were persistent. And at times, that was the only thing that, you know, faith was predicated upon, that it was just insistent. Not being absolute, not being easy, but it was just there. It just kept kind of coming up again and again. And I think that she just did a wonderful job with it.
So one of the great advantages of an audio podcast is that our audience can hear you read your work. Would you mind reading the first one called back?
Mm-hmm. I will. This poem, as you pointed out before, many of these poems have quotes from many sources, Emily Dickinson, or also from the scripture, Old and New Testament. And sometimes they're very accurate, sometimes they're corrupted, sometimes they're changed. But this one has a quote from Samuel, the book of Samuel. And in that book, there's a moment when Samuel is sort of called to, the voice of God calls to him when he's in the temple with Eli. And at first, when he's called, he thinks it's Eli calling him. And he keeps waking up and saying, "Here I am, you called me." And Eli says, "No, I didn't call you. Lie back down, go away, it wasn't me." And he does this three times, and finally Eli recognizes and realizes, "Oh, I'm not calling Samuel, it's actually, God is calling Samuel." And he says, "Go back, and next time he calls, don't come to me, you know, listen to this voice and interact with it." So the poem is sort of about this, again, this being called back to an idea of faith, thinking about, again, you know, returning to ideas of faith and spirituality. So it's entitled, "Called Back, Called Back." Acquit me, make me purblind, unbloomed, a thing that, when roused, remains dormant, unused, none among many, as the bulb that persists within its sullen, despondent mood, alive, but no more, no better, than some kind of senseless meat. I turn toward you, but wherever I turn, I encounter the same soft refrain. I did not call you, lie back down. I did not call, lie back, lie down. There is death, and then there is sleep, or I no longer know who's calling, or what I've heard, or what I'll say. As, when roused once more by your voice light, its endless drag and weight, I move as a tuber on the verge of swelling, the called forth fruited body, caught between monad and many, between almost and already.
your poem. The poem begins with a startling request from the speaker, which seems kind of a plea for mercy, acquit me. But then it goes further. It asks to be transformed into something that, when I first read it, seemed really unlikely, an unbloomed, unused thing that the speaker later imagines as a bulb, alive but no more, no better than some kind of senseless meat. And then the speaker does transform in the act of turning away. And I was just wondering, how did the image of the bulb come to you?
It's a direct reference, well, for me at least, to reading. We're always reading as we're writing, and we're influenced by that. Eliot. I was thinking, of course, of Eliot, and I think specifically, whether I knew it or not, there's a definite reference to even the wasteland. In the beginning of the wasteland, April is the coolest month. That things growing and wanting to sort of experience transformation or rebirth, but having a very, very, very tough time of it. And that, coupled with this idea of rebirth, is next to that is also death. It's just that these two things are happening. And the sort of stubbornness sometimes of growth, that the bulb of the flower doesn't want to come out, that sometimes it wants to remain dormant, it wants to stay inside that place. And I think that this is what the book is, the anxiety that the book is illustrating, wanting to think about faith, wanting to edge towards it, but being very reluctant, being very afraid, and not wanting to be bothered with it as well. So I think that's the beginning of the poem, is saying, not wanting to do this, not wanting to be called out, not wanting to have to even think about it, because that just causes more complexity and difficulty and pain. So being caught, I think it was really, I really enjoyed the ending of the poem, this being caught between two things, between one thing, this idea of being the monad, just being singular and sort of unbothered, or being many, between almost and already, sort of in this liminal stage or space between believing or not believing. And sometimes, and I think I've been operating in that space, right in between, not deciding one or the other. And the book and the poems and the writing of the poems was asking me to sort of at times make a decision, and that's was the process. I don't think it's ever resolved. I think it's still terribly unresolved in the book, but the process itself, I think, is evocative and stimulating enough to get people, or it got me thinking about that issue. So.
And I just love the sound when you quoted from Samuel, "I did not call you, lie back down. I did not call, lie back, lie down." And the way that you change the rhythm and the restatement, I find a lot of emotion in that change. It gives sort of a charge of tenderness. Mm-hmm, It sounds like a parent soothing a child.
Right.
I was curious, you often cite the Bible in your poems. It seems like one of the primary impulses in the book is an engagement with the body as word. And in this case, as you were saying, that you're always reading, talk a little bit more about that. How does reading enter your writing process?
Many different ways. I think in this case especially, these quotes from Scripture had been kicking around in my mind for years. I mean, I'd been very familiar with and sort of had forgotten about. And they kept sort of emerging. And at times when I was writing the poems, I'd have sort of ideas or glimmers that or reminders of these quotes from Samuel, for instance, or Mark, or whatever it was. But I didn't really remember them, so I'd have to. It was very investigative. I had to go back to this text that I had sort of abandoned initially and wasn't really interested in anymore, and sort of do some more work. I had to go back and read Samuel and see what's happening there. And I found new things I hadn't thought of before. And I found things that worked really wonderfully with poems as I was already writing them. Sometimes they were already finished. In fact, there's a few in there that I'd finished already and had thought, and I had sort of these really loose allusions to Scripture or quotes from the Old or New Testament. So in my investigation of going back, I found that some of this language was quite beautiful. I didn't gravitate towards the Psalms. Interestingly enough, those more poetic elements of Scripture, I didn't really gravitate towards. I thought they were doing fine just by themselves. But the stories, I thought sometimes the stories and the drama that sort of occurs in some of these stories, I think is wonderful. And Samuel's a great example of that. This person who, as a young man, is being called to but doesn't know who's calling him. He's just very naive and sort of innocent at this point. And Eli, this parental sort of person, has to sort of figure it out for him and say, oh no, you know, it's not me calling, it's actually somebody else. You have to go listen to that thing. But the quotes came in, and as you pointed out, more often than not, they change. I was wanted to make them a part of the poem, and at times my memory of those quotes was wrong, and so I'd get them wrong, you know, in terms of syntax, or I'd miss a word here or there. And I felt that that was okay. Often the quotes, I do sort of change them to fit the poem, but they still do the work, I think. It's another way, I think, of interacting and even paying respect to that text, even if it's changed or altered in a way. So,
another poem I think of when you're talking about this process is one of my favorites, which is Newman. Would you mind reading that for us?
Newman. Provocation, voicelet. What moves in me awaits credulity, a torn sheet in which to wrap its weight. Solicitous attendant, O pilgrim, from the charnel house you must transpire, a shudder, a complaint. What stirs is not ancestry, nor the inception of any one blood, but the insistence to wake, to bear witness, comes as a stranger, from no one's mouth, no other arrangement. Your tongue, speech-pocked, unnerved, a whip circling overhead, my body forced to it, listening and listening, the imagined crack, its hiss, or what it might have said. Let those believe who may. A summons, let those believe, that gathers to itself a certainty. Let those believe who may, the more it leaves one behind. And belief now an unrest, growing singly in search of a pair, the absence of some other, your voice calling out to me, skeptic, refuser, Thomas's head as it continues to shake. Know this, I would not be here without you.
So I love the first line, provocation, voicelet. Voicelet, is that an invented word?
It is an invented word, yes. Actually, it's a word that I think someone else actually invented. I think Brenda Hillman gave me this word at some point. I don't really remember, but I remember her in relation to the word, yeah.
When do you know that a word is the precise one to use?
I don't know. I think through repetition more than anything else. I mean, you mentioned some words. One word you mentioned in particular, wound, appears in this book almost, I mean, almost in every poem. It just keeps happening over and over and over again. And when I was writing this book and these poems, there were times when I was repeating words, many words, over red and wound and wound and red. I just kept repeating the same. You know, these words appear again and again and again. And I know at times we're sort of taught to not repeat, that repetition is sort of lazy and not very, you know, inventive, and we have to sort of be more original than that. We have to sort of push a bit further. But it was interesting in this poem that they were insistent, and I became very insistent that part of the process for these poems was that I was going to repeat myself, and the poems themselves and the process of writing poems often is about repetition and almost rewriting the same poem over and over and over again. So at first, when drafting and going over this manuscript, I would highlight some of those words that had been repeated again and again, and I thought I'd go back and excise them and change them and go to my thesaurus and find something better. But I realized that they didn't have to, and that was the whole point, that like poems and like themes inside poems, that words themselves can go through a transformative process. They can be, the womb can be one thing in one poem, and then it can become quite something different in another poem. Or it becomes its own sort of sequence, that the word itself becomes a way for the reader to sort of follow through and see how the poems are moving and how that word is sort of carrying them through, the one thing they sort of can recognize and see how it moves through the stages of the book. But other words, and especially the invented words, I mean, I feel like I really, really had a lot of fun putting words together. Voicelet, breath bloom, blood trail. It's an old trick, but sort of just inventing words with real words, but mostly by putting them together. At the time, I was reading a lot of Paul Celan, and Celan does a lot of I'm not going to be able to pronounce it correctly, neologisms, I believe is the term. And it's, again, this idea of inventing words with already pre-existing words. And he does it all over the place. Of course, they're translated, but they're just exquisite, that the words then themselves become these sort of sparks. I mean, it just you see that how language can be rearranged in this way that you had never thought of before, and it allows you to sort of think about things in, you know, in such a different way. So referring to a flower as a breath bloom, you think about what blooming is, what life is, and again, how blooming and the breath itself is sort of ephemeral and doesn't last for very long, and it has to keep breathing to be alive. And it sort of can, you know, that puff, the bloom, it's like a breath. It opens up, but then it sort of, you have to, you know, breathe back in, and then it opens back up, and then it goes back in. And voicelet, almost like this little exquisite little button, like the voice is this little thing that sort of latches on to something.
In this poem, it is the voice of an other. It's not a really definitive voice. There's something strange about it, so I think voicelet was cueing into that strangeness, and it's sort of the drive of, to me it seemed like what's driving the speaker in the lines of the poem. The forms, I think also what happens with the words is because in, you said the words are like a spark, and I think part of what contributes to that is that the form of your poem uses a lot of white space. Tercets are really rare. I didn't find a single quatrain, mm-hmm. for example. How does this factor into your imagining of the voice of these poems, the spaciousness of your lines?
I don't know. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of white space. And I think that, again, it's this sort of give and take. Again, it can directly refer back to the title, again, that I wanted to sort of evoke, even visually, very palpably on the page, that the poems are spare. They're meant to be sort of, again, a collection of what's left over, sort of going through and finding very small things, so that a small word can have a lot of import. It can spark, but it can be just that word. I've always been very interested in the line and the economy of the line. I really enjoy just the sort of the pregnant terseness of short lines or open space. And the open space with short lines, I think, allows the reader to sort of have that space to go back to lines, to sort of give the line or that phrase or that word space to sort of grow and to move around. So I think that, I mean, the poems wanted to evoke almost this idea of, yeah, picking up twigs and leavings from this sort of journey that I was on. And I think also ideas of prayer itself is itself necessarily sort of empty. It's sort of filled, but it's also empty. And I think that crawling out to certain things or responding to, you know, certain voices or, you know, a certain divine or sort of spiritual voice, you're looking for a response. I mean, the poems are sort of being called to, but also responding back to. And I'm hoping that the space at times was meant to evoke the absence of the response, that at times language and prayer itself necessarily fails. How do we articulate faith? How do we talk about our beliefs? And what can language do? And a lot of these poems is about that difficulty, that language can't approach a real, you know, it can't sum up faith. It can't talk about some of these issues. That language sort of fails, and so that sometimes we have to reinvent language. And so putting words together and making different words, or allowing for space or ellipses where you just sort of trail off and say, you know, it's you fill in the rest, or I don't know where to go from here, was definitely part of the process.
Tell me about the figure of Thomas in this poem, especially comes in at the end. The absence of some other, your voice calling out to me, skeptic, refuser, Thomas's head as it continues to shake. Know this, I would not be here without you. Tell me about Thomas in this poem.
The figure of Thomas, he appears, and he's throughout all these poems, and this poem in particular, and the story of Thomas, that he didn't believe, and it took a lot for him to finally believe in something. But he, again, was sort of in this liminal space where he was sort of between belief and between disbelief. His story is about after the crucifixion of Christ, and Christ has been buried, the talk of him coming back, and Thomas just doesn't believe in it and is not convinced until Christ appears to him and says, "Here I am." And it makes Thomas physically touch him and see that he's, you know, he's still here, he's still around. And Thomas's faith is returned, and Christ responds to him and says, you know, you needed to see me in order to believe, you know, but blessed are those who don't need to see but still do believe. And that's some of the crisis of this book, you know, wanting to believe or wondering how to believe, and sort of casting around for certain evidence or ways to believe. And I think Thomas is just sometimes the obvious example of this idea of disbelief, but a very palpable one, a very, very interesting one. And in that moment, in the New Testament, like you were pointing out before, it's almost a setup. I mean, Thomas is a device to sort of for, you know, for Christ to say, well, you needed to see me, but, you know, those who don't, you know, they really are the faithful. Those are the ones that believe. So Thomas is used for this example. I mean, he's sort of set up in a way. And I think that's really interesting that he's there in that case. And so the book is using that sort of device. Thomas is the setup. He's there for me to use as well as a device to sort of say, oh, look at this, the story of Thomas. You know, he doesn't believe. I don't believe. And the physicality, I think, is also quite important. Again, we were talking about how language itself often cannot suffice. It doesn't get you that much closer. And the body, especially in the Catholic faith, it's often about the body and what the body is, and the Word being made flesh, and the flesh being made Word as well. And it's a great, I just think it's a wonderful image to keep sort of moving, you know, back and forth with.
You often write poems in a sequence. There are several sequences throughout the book, and one I'm thinking of is "He calls me lambent, lucent." Would you mind reading that for us?
Sure. He calls me lambent, lucent. This poem is based very loosely on a quote that I came upon by the French poet and thinker Paul Valéry. And I want to read, I'll read that quote first just because it gives you a good entrance into the poem. It's a quote that I take throughout the poem and rework, quote it sometimes, change it, but it continues to reappear throughout the poem. So this is Paul Valéry. "Nothing so pure can coexist with the circumstances of life. We only traverse the idea of perfection as a hand passes with impunity through a flame, but the flame is uninhabitable." And again, it's the idea of faith. I mean, how to inhabit faith? How long can you inhabit faith? And what that's like? He calls me lambent, lucent. There's a quote before the poem starts from Joan of Arc, who also has to do with this idea of the uninhabitable flame, since she was burned at the stake. And when she confessed to the trial, during her trial, when she confessed, when she took back what she had said, her visions from Christ, her visions from God, that she heard the voice of God, this is what she said: "What I said for fear of the fire." And the poem is a bit about Joan, and in many ways. One, "The days are embers lit in my throat. When I speak, the timid fire that is my voice erupts. When I am hushed, the dark coal collapses back into itself, and nothing comes out. The fire lasted for as long as I allowed it to sing. Then it became a scattering of intermittent light that shone intermittently upon my breast, a tableau vivant where my heart used to be. I did not foresee my words becoming such a reverie of mimic and refrain. Once I spoke, I dared not fetch them from the flame. 2. We speak like matches in a mirror, each flagrant reflection a portrait of restraint. There is so little to go on, each wooden stem only lasting so long. Soon we are ash and soot, to be swept up and carried away. In absence, a stain, an occasion for memory. There is no resemblance to light, only the words that continue to come out like bits of ash, like a bird passing through an uninhabitable flame. 3. Inseparable from the fire, your words take precedence over it. What you have to tell me begins as a half-lit flower, but then unfolds, erupts. And although the air smokes with its petals, its holy perfume, I can still make out your offer. Overhead, I hear the shuttling of wings in the dark, your voice a spark that goes on firing, the fire not far off. 4. Head full of soot, I cannot give pardon to the wind that whips my thoughts about. Absorbed as I am, it isn't easy being led. I follow your chemical trace through the sulfur pits. I will use their chimney smoke as vaporous crumbs to find my way back. But if I return, I will burn everything that reminds me of you. I will pretend the journey never took place, never left its indelible blush in my skin, its fitful fever of again, again. 5. To pass with impunity through the flame, the hand does not think so. Singed or else caught in a labyrinth of orange and white, white and orange, its fingers cannot take hold. Between cinder and flare we meet, the alleged arsonists. Is this warehouse on fire your love letter? Do the sirens add ornamentation to your already engulfed voice? The conflagration of wings that are the others fleeing, do you mean to make them so brightly lit, to give them your timid fuse, its promise of touch?
My main question about this poem is your choice to write in a sequence, and I can hear as you're reading the different sections how, for example, the image of fire is repeated in almost all the sections, but is really transformed or used differently in each one. So I was curious to know more about how you're using the sequence in this case, how that was your choice for this poem.
I'm usually pretty uncomfortable writing long poems. I usually don't actually have what it takes to write long poems. I usually don't have the stamina to really write longer poems. So one of the ways I found out that I could write longer poems was through sequences or through series. And again, it had a lot to do with this idea of repetition, that I could write one poem and then I realized that I wanted to write more about it, or I wanted to sort of revisit it or almost rewrite that same poem over and on the next page. This poem just began thinking about Joan of Arc. I was reading a book about her, the trial, and about her. And I was trying to inhabit her voice and almost write through her, but then it kept changing throughout the poem. I mean, I think it's sort of from Joan's perspective, but then it begins to keep moving. I thought that the series allowed for that. What I like about a sequence or a series is that it is still necessarily fragmented or disjunctive. I mean, you're not responsible in the same way as you are as writing a long, very long, many-paged poem. That you are allowed this sort of break. And that break means that you can sort of jump into something else, either a different voice, a different tone, a completely different image, or a different poem altogether. But it's the same, because you say it is. You say it's still a part of the series. And so it has to be, the reader has to be accountable in that way. You still have to consider it within the confines as a poem. So these things are related, whether they seem disparate or not. But this poem, I think you're right, the image is what carried me through, the image of fire, talking about ash again and again, and soot, carried me through. And it was about the sort of different transformations of that. This idea of the fire kept going through the poem, and that Joan was sort of talking to the fire, and in essence talking to, again, the divine through the fire, and that sort of relationship. At times it's reverent, at times it's a little, she's accusing, sometimes she's dismissive. And at the end, it still ends with this question. It's still sort of wondering or questioning the fire and what the fire is leading to. And again, this idea of faith. Other series or ideas of the sequence happen in the poem. Newman, for instance, I see it as it's a sequence poem. There's no numbers there, but there are breaks. Many of the poems have these breaks. And those are the later poems I wrote for the manuscript. And those are the poems I really enjoyed the most, because it took the sequence to a different level for me, that it sort of, instead of just putting them on different pages and still saying the same poem and giving them numerals or even separate subtitles, forcing them all into the same poem, on the same page, but putting a mark to sort of delineate or say, this is the break, or this is where the poem has been erased or disappeared, or this is where you just have to stop and then start over, I think is incredible. For me, it was. There's another poem here entitled My Easter, where some of the poem had been written in different times, different places, and putting them together was a real struggle. But I realized that I could do it as a sort of this sequence. I found it very, very informative for me as a poet, as a writer, as a process, that they didn't have to be on their own page and sort of separated. They could be together, even though they're really different, some of what was happening there. So.
Do you think writing the poems in this book have changed your faith?
I think it's hard to say. I think it's still, the book itself is really still quite organic. It's still growing. Often, for instance, coming here to Columbia to do a reading, I went through the book, and I still make changes. I'm still sort of revising some of these poems, which is kind of fun. And I'm actually writing a newer manuscript that I think is sort of a sequel to this. I feel the book is not done. There's still things I need to address and sort of move on to. There's no absolute resolve. I guess the only resolve that the book sort of ends up with is that I'm still there. I'm still going to think about it. I'm still questioning the ideas of faith. The book, there's a couple quotes. One of the early poems in the book has a line that I think is important, sort of again about the project. The line is, "Oh, help me through the fact of you, unfasten whatever arrives, someone once in." And this is, I think, this again crisis about faith, accepting faith, you know, being open to faith. And I don't think it's resolved necessarily by the end, because the last poem in the book, the last lines of the book, almost revisit that same line that I just read almost exactly. Where am I in this emergence? Who comes? So it's again, there's the invite, the openness is still there, but it's still questionable as to how it will be greeted and where it will go from there. So no, I'd say it's still unresolved. It's still very strange and confusing to me. I still don't really understand where this book necessarily came from. I'm figuring it out, but it's still pretty unresolved.
You mentioned that you're working on a second manuscript. If we've met all these figures in the first book, Samuel and Thomas and Joan of Arc and Eros, who might we meet in your second book?
There's two separate projects, and I think I do want to talk about both of them because I'm so heavily involved in both of them right now. The one that's very directly related to this is a book dealing with glossolalia, a series that I've started. I think it's going to be a book-length series, talking about the series, right? Really pushing the series as far as possible to an entire book-length manuscript. But it's about glossolalia. It's about speaking in tongues. So it's moving away somewhat from recognizable territory, Catholicism, my Catholic faith, towards sort of more Pentecostal, Baptist elements. But it's about speaking in tongues, but still the same sort of project, again, about language, about speaking, about faith, how to utter faith, how to speak to the divine, how does the divine speak to us. And what's really wonderful about this project, it's entitled Holy Ghost People, and it's a sort of collage series. And then throughout that poem, different voices keep occurring over and over and over again. I've cast the net much wider. It's broken into two parts. One is incorporates quotes from first-hand personal accounts from those who've experienced glossolalia. I've been doing a lot of research. So I've taken those first-hand accounts and sort of embedded them inside the poem. There's sort of the running theme. The person is sort of talking about how it first begins, what they experience, and how they sort of come away from it. And that's sort of the trajectory, the arc of the sequence. Along with it is interspersed all these other quotes. Quotes from other ways of, I think, that speaking in tongues work. So same figures, you know, scripture's definitely in there, but people like John Donne and Hopkins appear. Simone Veil appears in there again as well. But the other half of the manuscript deals with other ideas of speaking in tongues, or the muse, or being inspired, and includes its poetic elements of glossolalia. So Yeats is in there, and it refers directly to Yeats's book, A Vision, where he and his wife are doing automatic writing, and it's about these other spirits, you know, speaking to them through the divide. It's spiritual, but not necessarily in the way that Yeats, the way that I'm seeing it. There's another poet, Jack Spicer, who had a lecture, and one of his beliefs is that, again, we're sort of, you know, the poet and the poem has to be receptive to outside voices. Basically, we're sort of a radio that we turn on, and different frequencies come in. These sort of alien frequencies come in and speak to us or through us and go into the poem. James Merrill has a wonderful poem, The Book of Ephraim, which he uses the Ouija board, where he and his partner are using the Ouija board to speak to this other presence, this other spirit, who then sort of talks to them. So it's really fascinating, the very palpable religious experience of speaking in tongues, and how this seems to be occurring often also in poetry, when we talk about the muse or we talk about being inspired. And these poets really keyed into it and began to articulate this other presence, this other voice. And so I'm putting them together and seeing. So it's a very big collage work. It has all kinds of different voices informing it. And the other manuscript is this another, it's a verse drama that's about the life and work of the 19th century peasant British poet John Clare, late Romantic John Clare. And it's a verse drama that's based on a call and response. Clare is calling out to certain people in his life, and they're responding, basically. And at this point, the poem is primarily based upon his relationship with a girl that he knew and was intimate with when he was younger. They were boyfriend-girlfriend. They held hands. They, like, passed notes in school. But Mary, the woman named Mary Joyce. And when Clare becomes older, later he's confined to an asylum through a different assortment of reasons. And when he's in this asylum, when he's older and he's writing his poetry, he's often alluding back to this figure of Mary Joyce. And Mary Joyce becomes emblematic of his past, his childhood, and what's been lost and what he's trying to go back to constantly. So it's, again, speaking through his voice. I mean, I've really started taking on all kinds of voices and texts. It's quite divergent from thinking about Glean or even the other new book about glossolalia, but I think they're still in the same, it's the same place, looking for something, searching for something, speaking to a certain figure or presence that's not really available or that's not there. And Mary and Clare call and response is very direct. Mary will often respond directly back to him and almost chastise him for sort of using her as some sort of means of getting some sort of fulfillment, that she's not available there for him, and she's become this other idea for him. So the voices are there, yeah.
Well, best of luck to you as you're working on these new projects, and come see us again on your next reading tour.
I will.
Come through here.
I will.
And thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.